Tonight I want to talk about the heart's deepest desire, which is not a concept drawn from the suttas, from the ancient scriptures. It's one of those sort of contemporary ideas, like Buddha nature, or you've probably heard the statement, all beings want to be happy. These are sort of contemporary Western inventions. There are some scholars who are pushing back against these notions, you know, because they're not orthodox, Theravada teachings. But I personally find these expressions convey some very important ideas that touch on what I want to talk about tonight. Unfortunately, the sort of orthodox, traditional Theravada message, which comes across frequently as you suffer because you do something wrong, it kind of fits in with punitive Judeo-Christian ideas of sin, damnation, and guilt, and can be kind of a turnoff, not just to people who are first encountering it, but to people who've been practicing it for a while. Sort of, if everywhere you look inside yourself, you see the things that you're doing wrong, I can see that you get discouraged and not want to do this anymore. But there really is joy and a deep gratification to be had on the Eightfold Path. Even a brief meditation can bring simple pleasures of stress relief, changes in our approaches to life. This is a liberative practice that we're doing. We talk a lot about freedom. The very idea of desire sounds like it's condemned in the suttas, but that's not really so. Motivation is very important. And there can be confusion between desire and motivation. And I think what I want to talk about in this Dharma talk is the motivation, the drive that leads us toward what we want out of life. The problem with desires is with unthinking responses that we have toward urges and appetites, or what I'll call superficial desires, or the outer leaves of the artichoke that I mentioned in the email. I don't know if you got it, but I used the analogy of an artichoke. I'm referring to this as the Artichoke Sutta, which of course doesn't exist, I just made it up. But, you know, the outer leaves of the artichoke are kind of tough, and there's just this little tiny part at the bottom that's edible, and it's not all that tasty, a little bit. But, you know, as you go around and you pull off the leaves, you get to more and more tender leaves, and they'll have bigger bits that are more and more fun to eat. And eventually you've gotten through all of the leaves, and you're down to this kind of cup-like thing with spiky stuff, you know. And I can remember the first time I encountered that, I thought, well, I'm done with this thing. Those spikes were totally unappealing. But then some kindly grown-up taught me how to just cut around and scoop those spiky things out. And there was the heart of the artichoke. the most tender, most delightful part and nutritious part of this kind of food. Well, that's what I'm talking about with the heart's deepest desire. That motivation that's obscured by all these superficial desires that we have in our lives. Such as, now, you'll notice that a lot of these things are inherently wholesome, but it's the way that we approach them in our lives. Food, TV, games, video games, socializing. You know, I have friends who are just on this sort of treadmill of always going out and kind of doing the same thing. It can involve a bottle of wine or whatever, but it's sort of like they wonder why they don't have time to do other things that they want to do. And of course, there's nothing wrong at all with socializing, but anything we do can be overdone. Even sports, even sex, clearly drugs and alcohol, work, workaholism, reading, fantasizing. I have a dear friend who once said, "I just can't stop reading." And it was this place where she buried her awareness into the book every free moment she had, so that she didn't have to deal with what came up when there was a moment of quiet. These are the kinds of things that are referred to in the suttas as sensual desires. And that's not sensual in the sense of sexual, but the five senses. They're in the material world. Because we have this idea that happiness comes into us through the outside world. We get stuff out there, bring it in, and it'll make us happy. And when we do this excessively, we're getting really close to what was intended in the fifth precept, which is a vow that we take that says, "For the purposes of training the mind, we vow to abstain from intoxicants that cloud the mind." So, clearly, not wanting to cloud the mind makes a lot of sense if you're going to take a test, or if you're going to drive, or if you have an important meeting. But there's a more subtle and serious harm that comes from just a sort of a knee-jerk yielding to desires. Because what happens is they get entrenched, they get hardwired in our nervous system, and they get stronger. And they blind us to deeper, more wholesome desires or values that may be harder to realize and achieve. Many years ago now, I spent 5 years teaching people in the San Francisco drug court program how to meditate, which, as you can imagine, they were really eager to do. One of the first things I had to do was explain to them why they might want to do this. And so I would ask them, what was their heart's deepest desire? And I got some wonderful answers. They'd say, "Coming home to myself," or "wholeness," or "peace of mind," a sense of ease in my life, or freedom. Now, I thought it was striking that anyone in this population was going to be able to get in touch with their yearning for integrity. And by that I mean the integration of their inner life with the way that they were living in the world. And clearly, you know, if they had gotten in trouble so that the drug court sentenced them to learn how to meditate, then this was something that they didn't have, this integrity between the inner and the outer aspects of their lives. It's so easy to get trapped by these superficial desires because, you know, there's this pleasure that comes with them. It's like the sweetness of sugar compared to the good taste of broccoli. You know, which do kids go for? It's instant. It's clearly a pleasure. We like it. After I eat a chocolate ice cream cone on a hot day, I'm happy for about 20 minutes. And then I know that those empty calories are doing their worst to me. They're going right to my waistline, and they're raising my blood sugar, and the ice cream is raising my cholesterol count. I can feel this happening in my body. And those 20 minutes of, you know, sensory pleasure are very quickly just not worth it to me. So these superficial desires take us one step forward and two steps back. And they're really not worth it. Certainly not worth doing them so habitually that they get so deeply entrenched, so powerful in our lives. Lao Tzu, the sage of Taoism, wrote a poem that goes right to this point. He said, "Always we hope someone else has the answer. Some other place will be better. Some other time it will all turn out." This is it. No one else has the answer. No other place will be better. And it has already turned out. At the center of your being, you have the answer. You know who you are, and you know what you want. There is no need to run outside for better seeing, nor peer from a window. Rather, abide at the center of your being, for the more you leave it, the less you learn. Search your heart and see the way to do is to be. So we've gone around the artichoke at least once with the toughest outer leaves that give us the least nutrition, really wholesome stuff. This is the level of getting pleasure and avoiding pain, or getting and losing stuff. I mentioned before, but you may not remember, there are 8 worldly winds over which we're powerless. And I'm talking about the first 2 pairs of pleasure and pain and gain and loss. Well, beyond that first level of artichoke leaves, there are 2 other pairs. And that's praise and blame and fame and ill repute. And these are so important to us because we're social animals. These are the win and lose propositions of relating to other people and how they're going to relate to us. And at this level, like those soft leaves of the artichoke, we're soft. We're vulnerable. These are issues like our pride, our status, feeling shame, or whether or not we have any power. It's really hard to keep track of these desires because they hide camouflaged by our idea of who we are. They just sink right into what we think of as our being. And even when we can see them, it's hard to recognize how powerful they are. However, they operate very similarly to the most superficial desires. The more we act to satisfy them, the more entrenched they get, and the more they obscure our deepest desire. Not only do we not have control over praise and blame, fame and ill repute, our social goodies, but just like pleasure and pain and getting and losing stuff, it's so transitory. We get it one day, we lose it the next. They're like candles in the wind. And the satisfaction they bring is temporary. So let me join Rumi in urging, let yourself be silently drawn to the stronger pull of what you truly love. Now we're all uniquely able to access the center of our being, whatever that might be. The fact was that at the drug court, when I asked people what their deepest desire was, the majority of the faces had blank looks. It was just the occasional person who came up with those profound things that I read a little while ago. Those were the people who could somehow just, or at least at that moment, just tune right in. And that's true in my experience, that sometimes it's a lot easier for me to get in touch with what is my essential motivation in life, what's really important to me. Other times, I can't do it so well. Now, I mentioned scholars, Buddhist scholars, who are kind of on a campaign to take away the popularity of these expressions. Tenisiro Bhikkhu, who I respect tremendously, wrote an article against the notion of Buddha nature. And what he objected to with this idea was that some people were misunderstanding this to say that somewhere deep inside of us we're already enlightened. But in another article, there was this kind of dialogue, I think, between Tenisiro Bhikkhu and the Dalai Lama. Just a few months after that, or before that, the Dalai Lama wrote, "We all have Buddha nature in that we have consciousness, and therefore we have the capacity to become enlightened." Tenisiro Bhikkhu says that what we all have is a mind that can become enlightened when the fabrications of the mind have been removed. And these fabrications are sort of the rationales that we have for wanting and doing the things that we do. And as I mentioned just a few minutes ago, sometimes they're so embedded in our minds that we think it's us. We think it's who we are. When we remove these fabrications, according to Tanisiro Bhikkhu, or we can do this by continuous discernment of the mind's activity. And what this means, he's quoting the Buddha saying that we should explore the possibility of freedom as it's immediately present each time we make a choice. So I was chatting with Deb Kerr the other day about working on this Dharma talk, and you know, at that point I wasn't entirely sure where I was going to go. And she said, well, sometimes the way to your deepest desire is through the leaves of the artichoke. So this is kind of what Tanisiro Bhikkhu is suggesting. Constantly studying those outer levels of the leaves of the artichoke. Why are we drawn to those little bits of pleasure? How satisfying are they really? If the desires that we are more thoughtful in satisfying are better, then what makes them better? And as we watch ourselves casually appeasing our habitual desires, you know, the sitting down in front of the TV, or just diving into a book, whatever it is we do to blur our mindfulness, can we see those desires, those habits getting stronger? And can we see the consequences that they have in our lives? And why do we believe they're going to work? Why do we believe they're going to make us happy? Finally, when we have deconstructed some of these common cravings of ours and it falls away, how does that change us and our lives? And as they fall away, is it any easier for us to get in touch with our deepest desires? So there's a lot to study when we notice ourselves sort of knee-jerk reaction going for whatever it is we usually go for. Sometimes, or for some people, going through the outer leaves of the artichoke isn't going to be enough. Sometimes we have to take a whole meditation session, or set aside an afternoon, or go on a retreat, and just dive into this question of what is it I really, really want out of life? And to conduct this heartfelt inquiry, we need to quiet the mind's constant clamoring for distraction and give up those fleeting satisfactions for that period of time. Buddha said, to the mind that is still, the whole universe surrenders, and that includes our own hearts. We need to stop for a little while running outside or to the window and turn and just ask the heart, what is it? What is it you want? There are a lot of eloquent voices that encourage this exploration. And I'll quote one. It's a poem by David White entitled Sweet Darkness. You must learn one thing. The world was made to be free in. give up all the other worlds except the one to which you belong. Sometimes it takes darkness and the sweet confinement of your aloneness to learn anything or anyone that does not bring you alive is too small for you. Now, I can't tell you what you're going to find there in the depths of your heart. I do suspect that everyone in this room is a fairly normal human being who wants freedom from tormenting states of mind and a pleasant, abiding, and wholesome ones. But how that is held in your heart is uniquely yours, and only you can discern it. So let me end with a quote that always inspires me from Martha Graham. There is a vitality, a life force, an energy, a quickening that is translated through you into action. And because there is only one of you in all time, this expression is unique. And if you block it, it will never exist through any other media, and it will be lost. The world will not have it. It is not your business to determine how good it is, nor how valuable, nor how it compares to other expressions. It is your business to keep it yours, clearly and directly, to keep the channel open. You do not even have to believe in yourself or your work. You have to keep yourself open and aware to the urges that motivate you. Keep the channel open. Thank you.